Hello and welcome to the Muni Lowdown. My name is Paul Graves and I'm the managing editor for Debtwire Municipals. Today's podcast title is Stadium Finance Fervor. I'm joined by Neil DeMoss, author of Field of Schemes, and Kunal Kamal, a reporter on our team. We'll be discussing stadium finance deals. Kunal, welcome back to the podcast.
Hi, Paul, and welcome, Neil.
Neil, we're delighted to have you today. It should be a fascinating discussion.
Great to be here.
So, Neil, before we get into stadium finance, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and expertise in this area?
Sure. I've been a journalist reporting on sports economics for over 25 years. I'm co-author of this book, Field of Schemes, that looked in depth at sports stadium economics and politics. And I've been writing for various different publications, as well as running my own website, fieldofschemes.com, ever since then, continuing to follow up on these stories.
Great. Let me ask you a question on your perspective on stadium finance. Now, is it fair to say that you're skeptical of these deals? And if you are, why?
My co-author, Joanna Kagan, and I went into this sort of with a skeptical eye. You know, we saw that there were cities that were putting up an awful lot, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars towards privately used sports stadiums at the same time as they were cutting back on school spending and libraries and other public needs. But once we started investigating it, we discovered it was much worse than we thought. We thought, well, you know, there are some deals here, they're a little bit questionable. As we later discovered, the consensus of pretty much every economist in the country is there's no possible way for the public to earn back what they're spending on sports stadiums. You know, the benefits all accrue to the private sports owners and the public winds up holding the bag. And, you know, again, we've looked at this over the years and the arguments that are made for public funding for sports stadiums, it will create jobs. It does not create jobs. There have been innumerable studies showing that the old stadium is falling down. Teams owners always say that, and often it's the case that they just mean they want a new one they can make more money from. The teams will leave without a new stadium. This is something that owners always say, and in fact, teams occasionally leave, but most of the time, you know, they'll come back later and say, oh yeah, we never meant that. We were just trying to do that to get the money.
So Neil, let's just start with the big news for Tuesday. Jackson County voters rejected a sales tax extension to provide $2 billion for Kansas City stadium projects. I just wanted to know, what do you think about it? And where do you see the path forward for the Royals and the Chiefs from here?
Everyone was watching really closely how this vote in Kansas City was going to go. You had, obviously, the Chiefs and Royals owners putting on a, you know, full court press to try and get it passed. $2 billion in sales tax money over the next 40 years, which would have paid for roughly $500 to $700 million in upgrades for the Chiefs and then towards a new stadium for the Royals. There was a lot that still was to be determined. Royals owner John Sherman said he probably was going to need $1 billion total in public money. So that's another like $700 million that was going to have to come from somewhere. There were people in this Crossroads district where he wanted to build a new stadium who were going to be displaced, who were very upset about that. There was not a lot of consensus. You know, some elected officials were opposed. The Kansas City Star came out against it. So you had a situation where, on the one hand, there was a lot of opposition. But on the other hand, the teams were outspending the opposition by 20 to 1, 30 to 1, maybe 35 to 1 is the latest numbers I saw. And often that will be enough to make this pass. But in the end, voters voted it down by a pretty overwhelming margin. Now what happens? I mean, looking at history, typically the teams kind of go back, regroup, and come back and try and find a different way to get the money. The most famous example being in Seattle in 1995, I believe it was, where voters in Seattle turned down putting public money into a new stadium for the Mariners. And the Mariners came back just weeks later and said, okay, fine, if the city won't approve this, we'll just go to the state, and got the state legislature to approve it without any public vote. So I don't know if that's possible in Kansas City, but you have to imagine that John Sherman and Clark Hunt, the owners of the teams, are going to be coming back and trying to figure out, okay, we didn't get the money this way. How can we find the money some other way?
And for our audience, we're recording on Wednesday, April 3rd, and this vote took place, as Kunal mentioned, yesterday on Tuesday, April 2nd. So Neil, let's run down a few more stadium deals going on across the country. I want to turn my attention now to the Midwest, Chicago, with the Bears and the White Sox. What's going on over there?
So Chicago's a weird situation, right? The Bears have been trying to sort of kicked the tires on different stadium ideas for a while now. They bought land in Arlington Heights in the suburbs. They were talking to other suburban towns about ways to get a stadium deal through there. But at the same time, they've always been focused on building something down at the lakefront next to Soldier Field where they are now. And into the middle of this, you suddenly had the White Sox, whose owner, Jerry Reinsdorf, you know, famously was one of the first to use a move threat to get money for a new stadium back in the late 80s when he flew down to Tampa Bay, which didn't have a team at the time, and hung out there for a little while and came back right as the Illinois legislature was about to vote on a stadium and it squeaked through at the last minute. Jerry Reinsdorf is now back saying, again, he will move maybe to Nashville, maybe somewhere else, which is, I think, every sports observer thinks it's ridiculous that you would move from an enormous market from Chicago to a place like Nashville. But again, he's saying it as a way to try and get approved this enormous development that would include a new stadium in the South Loop. So right now you have the Bears and the White Sox sort of trying to jockey for position in terms of who will get tax money. There's talk about hotel tax money and property tax kickbacks and all sorts of other things that could be in the billions of dollars. It's still kind of early in the process. The governor there has been... I think skeptical is probably the best word about putting a lot of public money into this. There's a lot of negotiations still to go on. And again, this is not a situation like in Kansas City where necessarily people are going to get to vote on it. So it might be something that, you know, just gets decided by state legislators and city council folks.
So let's turn our attention back to the East Coast, more like the Mid-Atlantic, I guess I'd say. The Washington Wizards and the Capitals. There seemed to be some dust up around maybe they were moving to Virginia. Now it looks like that's dead and they're going to stay in D.C. Can you make sense of that one? What's been going on there?
Ted Leonsis, who's the owner of the teams, had this whole idea to go to Virginia, Alexandria, Virginia, and build, again, another one of these giant sports developments. This is very much an increasing trend, is we're not just building an arena or a stadium, we're building an entire district. And part of that is because team owners figure they can make more money that way, right? Because you're not just selling tickets, you're also selling housing, or you're renting out space, or you're renting out space at sports bars. Part of it is also, I think, that team owners realized a while back that if you're just asking for money for a sports team, you get all these economists saying that's not worth anything. And you get sports fans saying, why should we give you money for your team when we're already paying through the nose for tickets? Whereas if you say, oh, but it's not just that, it's a mixed use development, that kind of muddies the waters and gets people thinking, well, you know, it's not just about sports. As things went down, the governor in Virginia did not do a great job of winning over, he's a Republican and did not do a great job of winning over Democrats in the state legislature. And, you know, in particular, one state senator, Louise Lucas, stood up and basically said, I am not going to give this arena bill a hearing in my committee, and shot the whole thing down. It officially collapsed, you know, about a week ago. And immediately Leonsis said, okay, fine, we're going back to plan B, which was to take about $500 million that he had been offered by the mayor of DC to upgrade his current arena. On the one hand, it's a success in that somewhere north of $1 billion that was going to be spent in Virginia was shot down by elected officials. On the other hand, Leonsis did manage to use that as leverage to get $500 million out of DC. As with a lot of these deals, it's sort of a mixed blessing in that maybe the worst thing didn't happen, but there's still an awful lot of public money that is going to go to a private sports team owner.
And let's keep moving down the coast. Let's go to the southeast. Tampa Bay Rays. What's the situation there?
Yeah, the Rays have been trying to get a new stadium for decades at this point. Their old one was built in the 80s, again, on spec, right? It was built with no team actually there, and the team didn't arrive until 1998. Their owner, Stu Sternberg, has been sort of hamstrung by the fact that the previous owner actually agreed to a really, really strong lease that basically said he couldn't even talk to other cities about moving somewhere else until 2028. That finally has been renegotiated, and he's trying to get a deal from the city of St. Petersburg that would build a new stadium next to the old stadium. The cost is kind of up in the air, but it looks like when you add together you know, direct funding from the city and the county and tax breaks and land discounts. It could be somewhere as much as $1.5 billion, which is a crazy amount of money. And it's especially strange because all the complaints about the Rays, who have been a very successful team but haven't sold tickets very well, is that people don't like to go sit in a dome in Florida in the summer, right, when the weather's nice. Might want a roof when it rains, but they don't want to be, you know, stuck inside all the time. And that the site is across the bridge, a long, long bridge from a lot of the people who would want to go to games who are in Tampa. And now they're talking about building a stadium that is also going to be a dome, a fixed roof dome, and it's going to be right next door to the old one. So it's really unclear what problems this solves, unless the problem, again, is that the team owner just wants a whole lot of public money and will sort of figure out how to make use of that later on.
Let's go back up the coast to the Northeast. Situation I find fascinating because it really seems like the city truly identifies with this team in terms of Buffalo and the Buffalo Bills. What's going on there?
The Buffalo Bills owners, again, had been talking for a while about wanting a new stadium and got through a proposal by the governor, Kathy Hochul, who is from Buffalo, who managed to put together a package of, again, about $1 billion in public money between the state and the county that she proposed at the last possible second, didn't put it in her state budget, didn't talk about it all winter. Then when this legislative session was about to expire, she just dropped it on them with like a week to go. There was no time for discussion and just sort of pushed it through. My son's actually in college in Buffalo, and so I know all about how rabid Bills fans are. People are certainly happy about not having to worry about the team moving and maybe getting, you know, a nicer place to watch the game. But at the same time, they are very upset about things like not just the level of money that was put up by the public, you know, from their tax money to build this new stadium, but also now they're going to have to pay through the nose for personal seat licenses, right? Where they're going to have to pay as much as $50,000 per seat, not even for the tickets, but just for the right to buy tickets. So people are not happy about that. But again, of course, this is something that was not announced in advance, right? You know, one thing that team owners and politicians learn is save all of the bad news for later and just talk about the happy stuff up front, you know, show the pretty pictures. And if you're going to charge people $50,000 just for the right to renew their seats, maybe don't mention that until after the vote.
I remember personal seat licenses when it came up with the Meadowlands Stadium. That was my first experience with that. I remember thinking, this is strange. I'm not buying season tickets. I'm buying the right to buy season tickets. Why would fans go for that?
This was realized in the 90s by the Carolina Panthers, I want to say, when they were trying to get money for a new stadium and they were having trouble getting it from the public. And they realized, hey, we have all these people on the season ticket holder list, right? We've got a wait list. You know, this is something that's valuable that we're not charging them anything for, right? We are allowing them to have a spot in line and priority for renewing their season tickets, and we don't charge them for it. So the idea was you're going to have to put up money up front to secure your spot in line. And then later on, you can sell it, right, to somebody else. That sounds, I mean, not great, obviously, if you're being faced with having to spend, you know, tens of thousands of dollars. But okay, if you can recoup it later by selling it to the next person who wants to get on the line when you're giving up your season tickets, it's not terrible. The catch, of course, is what happens when the stadium goes away, right? And now we're talking about things like the Chicago Bears wanting a new stadium, and people already have paid, you know, seat licenses for the old stadium. And if you move to a new one, are they going to have to put up new money for season tickets there? Is it worth it? Is the right to season tickets worth anything when the stadium is about to go away? So there's not going to be any tickets to buy there. It's really, you know, not quite a scam, but there are an awful lot of ways that it winds up funneling more money from fans to owners than I think would happen otherwise.
The last project I want to bring up, Neil, I grew up in Los Angeles, so I have a West Coast bias. So anytime I can talk about something from the West Coast, I do. So this is a project in Las Vegas with the Oakland A's. This is another confusing one to me because it doesn't seem like Las Vegas is embracing or welcoming the Oakland A's with open arms, but Oakland is still trying to move. And there's some questions around the ownership in Oakland in terms of what they've been doing and what Oakland is trying to offer as the city. Piece this together for us.
Yeah, this is another strange one. The owners of the A's, first, you know, Lou Wolf and now John Fisher, have been talking about a new stadium somewhere in the Bay Area, usually for, again, well over a decade. Only recently did Fisher and his team start sort of kicking the tires on, well, we might want to try and move if we can't get money out of Oakland. And they had a deal in place with Oakland. They were going to build a new stadium and a, you know, another one of these mixed use developments down by the waterfront. They were going to get probably close to $1 billion, maybe $700-800 million in infrastructure money from the city to help build, you know, new underpasses and, you know, new transit to get people down to this fairly isolated waterfront site that was an old industrial site. And then somewhere along the way, they weren't happy with that. And the ownership said, okay, we're going to focus on Las Vegas now. No one really knows whether John Fisher, who's, by the way, one of the heirs to the Gap, no one really knows whether Fisher was really serious about moving to Las Vegas or was just using this as a, you know, ploy to try and get more money out of Oakland. But immediately what happened then was the mayor of Oakland said, okay, fine. If you want to move to Las Vegas, go ahead and do that. And at that point, you know, Fisher had kind of caught the car and had to figure out what to do with it. There's now the situation where he got about, you know, $600 million worth of goodies from the Nevada legislature last summer. But he's talking about building a stadium that's going to cost well over $1 billion and needs to come up with, you know, a lot more money to pay for it. He's got a site that is 9 acres large, which is way too small for the kind of domed stadium he's talking about. So everyone's just been sort of sitting around waiting to see what the next step is going to be since last June, and nothing has really progressed. So at the same time, this stadium at best can't be built until 2028. The A's lease in Oakland expires after 2024. So he needs a place to play for at least the next 3 years. Everybody in Oakland hates him. Nobody is going to the games. The only reason that the A's would stay in Oakland monetarily is that they've got this lucrative cable deal there. Nobody cares about the team. Oakland is still at least a large market. So you've got this weird game of chicken going on between everyone where, you know, Fisher is negotiating with the city and Fisher is negotiating with Las Vegas. Nobody knows if he wants to really wants to move to, I think it's the 41st largest market in the country, to a stadium that nobody knows how it's going to be paid for. And there's a lot of hope, I think, among Oakland fans that either Fisher will just decide to throw in the towel and sell the team to someone local in Oakland, or Major League Baseball will be like, man, this is looking like a disaster. We're going to kind of twist his arm and get him to do it. But no one knows at this point, you know, and we're just, the season has started and pretty soon they need to start making up schedules for 2025. And really, we have no idea whether the A's are going to be playing in Oakland or Las Vegas or Sacramento or someplace else, either in the near or far future.
Neil, I know you're a fine journalist. I know you look at all sides of an issue. And I want to give you a chance. I know you're skeptical on stadium finance. So is there anything, because I haven't heard anything positive yet. Is there anything positive about any of these stadium finance projects? Anything at all?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit like trying to say, you know, what's the upside of a bank robbery? You know, there's a whole lot of public money going out and not much coming in. People always ask me, are there good deals? And I think the best deals are the ones where, first of all, obviously you want a good design and you want something that sort of, you know, fits in with the local neighborhood, but mostly you want to keep the public cost low, right? When you're talking about, I don't know, $50 million, $100 million in public money to kind of grease the skids for a multi-billion dollar project, maybe there's a way, if it's well designed, that it could be you know, worth that kind of expense. When you're talking about $500 million, $1 billion, $1.5 billion, that's just throwing money down a hole. You know, there is no possible way the public is ever going to see that kind of money back. Again, talking about the West Coast, I think the San Francisco Giants Stadium, the Warriors Arena, the redo of the arena up in Seattle, there are a few examples of cases where, you know, the public money was minimal, and I think everybody's sort of pretty happy with the way everything turned out. A big piece of that is because, and we're talking about the West Coast, is on the West Coast, it's a lot easier to force a public vote on these things, right? A public referendum. And as we've seen in the past, it's more difficult for a referendum to get passes about half the time than it is to just sort of push something through the legislature where you can just, you know, flood the zone with lobbyists and get it done that way. One of the lessons that we're seeing, again, especially this week from Kansas City, is that if you want to keep the public costs minimal, you want to make sure that the public has a say in it, a direct say in it. And then maybe at least you have a hope that the team owner will negotiate to something that, if not necessarily a win-win, is a win-not-lose.
Neil, you follow like a lot of stadium finance situations closely. So I wanted to understand how often the bonds which are issued for these projects go into trouble, and what happens when the team actually leaves the project to move to a different site. So for example, like Oakland A's, or if Chicago Bears leave Soldier Field. So what happens to those projects then?
Yeah, there are a lot of different ways to finance these deals, but I would say it's most common that the bonds are not based on just the stadium revenue, right? You know, you want to have some sort of backstop, which usually just winds up being the general fund, because understandably, bondholders are going to be antsy about, oh, I don't know if we want to buy bonds, you know, on something that's going to be paid for just with a stadium, when we see how frequently teams pick up and move, not necessarily to a different city, but just even to a different stadium in the same city. I think the answer there is that even if the project itself doesn't bring in money for the city or the county or the state, usually the, you know, taxpayers as a whole are on the hook for, well, if this doesn't work out, we'll just pay for it out of general revenues, or, you know, out of some kind of guaranteed revenue stream, like, you know, sales taxes or hotel taxes or something like that, that will come in regardless of whether the stadium itself is a success. And then there are certainly examples of places where the economy has taken a dip and there's had to be a bailout of the bonds. The one that immediately comes to mind is Cincinnati, where the Bengals had a bond that was supposed to be paid for by some sort of tax revenues. And when it didn't come through, Hamilton County just said, okay, we'll just sell a hospital in order to make up the difference.
Well, thanks, Neil, for giving us some hope to those people that are have a more favorable view towards stadium finance. But before we go, Kunal, I know you're working on a project around stadiums, the Stadium Tracker Project. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
We are coming out with this Detroit Municipal's Stadium Tracker this week, which will follow currently developing stadium situations, how much public money is going into it, and where these situations are in their current stage.
Neil, thanks a lot for joining us. Kunal, thanks to you for joining us as well. Looking forward to an ongoing dialogue on this subject. To our audience, I hope you found this podcast to be informative. Please support us by liking, sharing, and/or subscribing to Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Until the next time, thanks for joining the Muni Lowdown.